Any species that gains access to a very suitable piece of habitat that it previously hadn't occupied will tend to proliferate when it gets in there. It's a great opportunity. We can expand. And let's see, what's the biblical expression? Be fruitful and multiply. But eventually, if you multiply enough, it's no longer the kind of opportunity or set of opportunities that it was originally, because of not only exhausting maybe some of the resources that made it so attractive in the first place, but also overloading the system as far as the waste products that life necessarily gives off. And when you saturate the system so that it can't reprocess those waste products, make them harmless, and perhaps even turn them back into resources that you can use, the system itself begins to break down. And then you've had it. Humans are somewhat like that. We've invaded this planet by being born into it. Literally, we invaded this continent by not having our ancestors been born here, but they came from across the sea. Oh boy, wonderful continent here, full of mashed grapes. And so we start using it voraciously, and we put effluents into the water and into the air, and we're changing that drastically. And the more we have relied upon non-renewable resources, and in particular now, let's focus on the fossil fuels, the more we've drawn our energy from fossil fuel sources, from ancient photosynthesis rather than contemporary photosynthesis, the more we're like those yeast cells in the wine vat. And sooner or later, the byproducts of our living accumulate in the environment, make it less and less habitable, and the usable products we've taken out more and more, and so it isn't the same as it was before. There have been human blooms and human crashes in the past. The Easter Island example that I talked about in there, and then there's another whole book about it by somebody whose name escapes me at the moment. And it's also dealt with in the Jared Diamond's book on collapse here. And he talks about the settlements in Greenland that in a sense, there was a bloom there, modest compared to what we're doing now. But anyway, the community that crashed and so on. So there have been a number of instances of going through the complete cycle. And there are many small instances in this country. In the West, there's all kinds of ghost towns around places where they were utterly dependent upon extraction of a mineral resource. And once it's all gone, the community dies. Where are we collectively, the global population, in respect to this? I guess on the brink is as good a statement as we can make about it, that we are awfully close to the global oil peak, after which things are going to be downward, as we don't have that abundant fuel, and we'll have it in some abundance, more than in times past, but not more than very recently. And it'll be not cheap the way it was in the past, and we won't be able to do the things with it that we did in the past. So we're on the brink in that respect, but not a brink where we're going to go off the cliff and suddenly everything is going to be gone. There is a little book called The 29th Day, and it's talking about a 30-day month. A hypothetical pond in which the lily pads double each day. And it starts out with just a little bit of way over in this one side of the pond. Here's some lilies. And they double each day. And so on the 29th, it's going to take 30 days of 30 doublings to cover the whole surface of this pond. On the 29th day, you've still got half of the pond is open water. And if the lilies were reasoning like we humans do, they would say, oh, look at all that open space there, nothing to worry about. And yet they're only one day short of ruination, where there's no further room for expansion. Succession refers to the series of different biotic communities that will occupy a site, where the one biotic community transforms the site such that it then becomes a different biotic community because the site is different, which then becomes still different when the site is still different, and so on. And the series of such communities is referred to as a sere, S-E-R-E, and succession is seen as simply a natural ongoing process that that does result from this reaction that the biotic community has upon the site, the environment. The environment acts upon the biotic community. The biotic community can only be what it is given certain site characteristics. But it reacts upon that site by its use of it, by the way it lives, which then changes it, which then changes the nature of the community. The association of different species of organisms that are there and the relative abundances of the different species populations is going to change through time. That's succession. Most ecosystems, if you define an ecosystem simply as a delimited amount of environment and the biotic community that's living on that, have some species that influences the environment and the other species more than other species influence the whole. Most ecosystems in which humans are involved, humans tend to become dominant, and we have become more and more dominant. We have more impact on the rest of the ecosystem than other parts of it have on each other. That dominance is precarious in the sense that, A, we do things to the ecosystem we don't intend to do that make it less suitable for us, and B, even if we weren't damaging it in that respect, some of the other species are going to fight back. You could argue that there are competitors that are striving for dominance, whether consciously or not. I mean, what did we do when we took over this continent? We cut down an awful lot of trees because the trees were competing with us for the use of space. We wanted to use that land to grow food crops on, and so we cut down the trees. Trees constantly sprout seedlings, and so you could argue that although the tree is not a conscious organism, it's trying to reinstate its dominance, the various tree species. And if left alone, if you abandon a farm, eventually it will turn into various other versions of an ecosystem, eventually possibly a forest like it was before you cut it down and made a farm out of it.
Right.
That's part of the succession process. Much of what human life consists of is trying to roll back succession. And yet, it's a form of succession itself when we take over from the prior species that had made the ecosystem so suitable for us. So that was one kind of succession, but we're trying to roll back the natural succession that would tend to turn the farm back into a forest. Carrying capacity, as defined by the ecologists that are thinking in terms of deer or buffalo or whatever, would define it as the maximum population of a given species a particular environment can support indefinitely. A lot of people forget that word indefinite. Even biologists I've seen in some of their textbooks don't put that word in at the end. And that's essential because that refers to the fact that you're talking about a long time span, not just how many deer can graze on this habitat right now. The maximum population of a given species, because obviously more mice could be supported on a given acreage than elephants. So, of a given species, a particular environment can support indefinitely. Now, for humans, it's different because humans live differently in different societies. And the humans back in the Neolithic age were living differently than humans in the Industrial Age. So, human carrying capacity would be the maximum human population living with specified organization and technology that a particular environment can support indefinitely. The word indefinitely is still there, and it's essential. The phrase carrying capacity is troublesome. People aren't quite sure how you can define it and what it means and so on. And let me try to home in on the meaning of the term carrying capacity. I used to think of it simply as how many people can be fed. But there's a lot more to it than that. How many people can be fed and fueled? How many people can be fed, fueled, and supplied with all this apparatus and so on? How many trees can be cut down so that we can make paper for academicians to write books? there are limits on all of those things.
And also on the waste.
Yeah. And how many people can survive in an environment in which all these waste products are having to pile up somewhere or contaminate the atmosphere and so on. I think the way we're living now, the world was overpopulated already by the time of our Civil War. If we had stopped population growth, well, even better, if we'd stopped population growth at the time that Malthus wrote, there would have been difficulties in stopping it because that changes the age structure of the population and so on. And you'd have suddenly a lot of old folks with not enough young people to support them and so on. So it would have been a miserable process trying to make the transition rapidly. And it's going to be a miserable process as we try to make the transition not quite so rapidly, but too rapidly anyway for comfort in the 21st century. We're going to be making that transition because we are right now passing over the peak of oil production in a world in which we've made so many societies so dependent on that resource. Mm-hmm. So if you want a ballpark figure, I would say 1 billion would have been more than enough. Here we are with over 6 billion now, and that means that somehow we've got to devise a way for obtaining a soft landing as we reduce the population from 6+ billion down toward 1 billion. By the time we got down to 1 billion, we will have already used up a lot of the resources and done a lot of the damage to the environment that we're now doing, so that even 1 billion by then will be excessive. Whereas if we'd stopped with 1 billion when we first passed through that mark, it wouldn't have been excessive. There is such a thing as limits. Right. Carrying capacity is a finite, even though vague and sometimes somewhat flexible, mm-hmm. concept, it isn't unlimited. And we need to think that way. And it's not just a case of there being too many of us. We are too big now in terms of all the accoutrements that we have of modern civilization, right. that make the individual human being not just a 100 to 200 pound creature that has to eat some food and so on, but all the apparatus that we have makes us a whole lot bigger. I've got another, this is one of my little exhibits that shows that idea. The human nose that has to breathe the air, so we don't want all of these pollutants going into the air that we breathe. But Homo colossus, as I call modern man, has all this apparatus that they are our servants. All of these machines, all these trucks, all these aircraft, all these trains, ships, and so on, factories, they are our servants. They produce things that we want. But they are also our competitors, because we are competing with them for breathable air and for potable water and so on. So that's an insight that you get when you start thinking ecologically instead of assuming that the social sciences are completely separate from the natural sciences. The question is not simply how many people can occupy a given amount of space here, but what kind of metabolic load do we impose upon the ecosystem of which we are a part. And I start here by showing what it was like at the time of the first census, when we were just a little bitty country, you see, just the eastern seaboard there and reaching partway west. We had some western lands, but they hadn't been carved up into states yet. Anyway, in terms of the amount of apparatus that we had and the energy use that we were capable of in those times, it was as if there were about 5 one-ton dinosaurs per square mile of the territory of the U.S. at that time. Now, by 1980, when I was beginning to be well immersed into this ecological thinking, we had so much more apparatus, and the amount of energy that we were using was such that we were, each individual human American was equivalent in energy use to a 41-ton, that's metric tons, dinosaur, as if there were 64 of those per square mile of U.S. territory. So we had increased the territory, but we had also increased our numbers prodigiously, as everybody knows. But as most people don't take into account, we had increased our effective magnitude per capita. Right. And so the load is terrific. If you can imagine the United States occupied by 64 41-ton dinosaurs per square mile, that's really what we're doing to our environment. If you had no people involved at all, but just big dinosaurs like that, each one 41 tons, the amount of energy use that they would be committing would be comparable to the amount of energy use that we, with all of our apparatus, and not only the personal apparatus, but the industrial apparatus upon which we draw when we use the products that are available to us. If we want to live the way we live now, Americans in the 21st century, there can't be as many of us as if we were willing to live the way the Indians lived before Europeans invaded this continent. Even the negative impact, negative population growth countries are not downsizing in this other sense of how much apparatus they use per capita. For the most part, they're still on the upgrade there. And so the load, which is the number of people times the per capita resource use, and that's basically measurable in energy terms, because the more energy, the more other resources you will use, that's not yet diminishing appreciably in any country. Overshoot simply means going beyond what the carrying capacity is into a time when you're damaging the resource base by having overshot. It was something that Malthus didn't recognize could happen. He thought of limits as being more limiting than they really are, more immediately limiting, let's say, than they really are. But the limits are still there, even if you overshoot them, and then you feel them subsequently. All too many people have been persuaded by the fact that most of us aren't starving right now, and that there has been big population increase since the time of Malthus, since the time of that first U.S. census, that somehow we've proven that Malthus was all wet. We haven't. What people forget is what Malthus was talking about was not that population is going to grow at that kind of a exponential rate, but that it could if it were unchecked. These are the two best-known sentences from the essay on the principle of population by Malthus, published in 1798, just 8 years after that first U.S. census. Population, when unchecked, increases in a geometrical ratio. We would say exponentially now, but that's a primitive term for it there. Subsistence increases only in an arithmetic ratio. In other words, population could go up like this. Sustenance would go up linearly. Those two words, when unchecked, are what most people forget about when they're thinking of Malthus. Malthus wasn't trying to say population will forever increase exponentially. That would be absurd. He was trying to say what it could do if there were no checks on it, and the whole purpose of his essay was to study the kinds of checks there were. And by and large, he was saying that we aren't going to like those checks, that vice and misery and pestilence were three of them. He talked about positive checks and negative checks, and the difference between those two categories was positive checks were anything that increased death rates, and the preventive checks, positive, not positive and negative, positive and preventive. Preventive checks were anything that reduced the birth rate. Okay, there have been both positive and preventive checks operating ever since the time of Malthus. There were such checks operating in his time. So here's the world figure. At the time that Malthus published the first edition of his essay, there were 950 million fellow Earthlings sharing the global ecosystem with Thomas Robert Malthus. If they had continued doubling every generation, as he showed they could do when unchecked, as the census data for the U.S. implied, as during the colonial period of the U.S., we had been doubling each generation. Today, that is 1998, there would have been 242 billion people on this planet if they had continued doubling every generation from that 950 million at his time. If unchecked, there would have been eight doublings by two centuries later, you see. Okay, by 1999, late in 1999, we actually passed the 6 billion mark globally. And a lot of people cite that growth from slightly under 1 billion to slightly over 6 billion now as proving that Malthus was wrong. He didn't know what he was talking about. We have managed to produce enough food to feed all these people, more or less. What about the 236 billion that aren't here that could have been if there were no checks on population growth?
Right.
That's Malthus has been proven right, not wrong, by what's happened. Those organisms are capable of over-reproduction. They can produce more progeny than it takes for replacement, which is what Malthus was saying when he says population, if unchecked, grows exponentially. He meant they can produce an excess, and we can produce an excess. Mm-hmm. He wasn't just talking about us. He was talking about all species in general, which is what Darwin then saw. And Darwin went on to explain how that made for a general pervasive competitiveness within a species population, which provides the basis for the operation of natural selection processes. Yeah, that was, I think, the way in which Malthus was wrong. Most people think he was wrong in saying we're going to go like this, you know. But really, he was wrong in writing as if it was not possible to exceed carrying capacity, even temporarily, as if the checks would work perfectly. Well, they haven't worked perfectly, and it is possible to exceed carrying capacity, but only temporarily. If you exceed carrying capacity, you then damage the environment upon which you're depending, so that its carrying capacity in the future will be less than it was, and you're going to leave some people stranded without means of support. Now, what happened in 8,000 BC, about 10,000 years ago now? Somebody discovered that some seeds that were spilled, seeds that they'd gathered from wild plants, instead of being eaten, some of them were spilled on moist ground somewhere near where they lived, and they sprouted and they grew. Aha, insight. Some smart Homo sapiens saw, and it was probably a woman, because the division of labor in hunting and gathering societies, it's the women that stay around where they cook, and that's where the seeds would have been spilled. They do more of the gathering, and the husbands or whatever were out doing the hunting.
And now we have the origin of the Eve story, having taken the apple.
That's right.
From the serpent.
Okay. Anyway, some woman got this bright idea. If we deliberately bury seeds, we can produce more of this usable product than grows out there naturally. And so from about 8,000 BC onward, including the men and the women, were starting to take over the management of the ecosystem around us. That's what agriculture consists of. Now, initially, it was just horticulture, by which I mean they had to either scrape the ground with their fingers or with a digging stick, something very primitive. At most, a hoe. They sometimes, sooner or later, devised a thing with a blade that they could dig up. So from about 8,000 BC onward, you got human beings managing the ecosystem to that extent. And that made it possible to live in a more settled way. You could begin to have villages instead of mobile troops, you see. So you could begin to accumulate more stuff. And they could begin to have more elaborate material culture than they had before. We started the takeover process even before Homo sapiens came around. I mean, our pre-sapiens ancestors were like any organism, taking over for its use what might otherwise have been used by some other creature. So for 2 or 3 million years, the humans and prehumans and hominids and prehominids have been doing this. Every species does it. Okay, we started doing it in more of a strictly human way with the dawn of agriculture, with the discovery of those horticultural methods that bury the seeds and water them and bingo, you've got more food. So I think of the takeover method really as really flourishing during what I called the age of exuberance, when we could start expanding our numbers noticeably by taking over the management of ecosystems. And then we started doing so even more when some of the most advanced cultures discovered that there was another whole hemisphere out there that they hadn't had access to before, and now we've got access, and whammy, we can really expand our numbers, both by colonizing that area, but also by extracting resources from there to send back to the old country and produce a more flourishing population, even in the British Isles, for example, and so on. Okay, that's the takeover method, when we just take over for our use resources that might otherwise have been used by either somebody else or some other species. And then with the development of machinery that could use fossil fuels, we were starting the drawdown method. There'd been little bits of it before that, but basically we started with the development of steam engines to draw down these exhaustible resources, non-renewable fossil fuels and mineral materials that we build things with and make things with and use in various ways now. Now, it wasn't an abrupt transition. You didn't have takeover method suddenly coming to a halt and the drawdown method going on from there. If you think of it as a bar chart here, you've got to have a slanting boundary between those two periods. And likewise, you'd have a slanting boundary between the age of exuberance and the post-exuberant age. We're living, in my judgment, very much in a post-exuberant age, but we're still acting as if we're in this exuberant age where we can continue expanding and growing and so on. I think it would look more like some of the ways of life that we've had in the past than it would like our way of life today. This is one of the ironies, of course, of our time, that even the phrase climax community has been misused by people who haven't studied the ecological literature, and they don't think of it in terms of this balance where it can go on and be self-perpetuating. They think of it in terms of, the vernacular sense of climax, where you've come to something terrific. And the jet age seems like the climax to a lot of people. I suspect that if you were to talk to the average man in the street in Tokyo, for example, you'd find a lot of people there thinking of climax meaning what they've got now, which is so much more than what they had pre-World War II. And the fact that they've come back from the devastation that was inflicted upon them in World War II and now are one of the dominant industrial societies of the world. Would make that use of the word climax seem altogether plausible, or whatever the Japanese word for climax is. Climax. In fact, we're not a climax community. We're anything but, because we are devastating the planet upon which we depend by the way and use we're making of it. Well, a city can only exist if it can bring in carrying capacity from outside the city limits. Right. A city could be defined almost as a human ecosystem that grossly exceeds the carrying capacity of its local environment. I had a colleague at the last place that I taught, which was Washington State University, who had a private plane. And he used to argue with me about that. What do you mean, overpopulation? He says, when I fly from here to Spokane, I see lots of open space down there. But he didn't realize that the people in the city are drawing upon that open space out there in the hinterland. And the idea that until we have built up the whole countryside to the density of downtown Seattle or something like that, that we've got nothing to worry about is absurd, because every city does depend upon a vast hinterland to make it go. Justus von Liebig was a German agricultural chemist who gave us what is called Liebig's Law, which is one of the principles of ecology. That is the least abundant required resource that determines the carrying capacity of a particular area. That's Liebig's Law of the Minimum. And that applies to all kinds of human activities. Unhappily, in the modern world, we've begun to think, gee, there's so much water out there in the ocean, all we need is desalination plants and nobody will have to go thirsty, and there'll be plenty of water for agriculture and so on. But the desalination plants require fossil fuels or some other source of energy, and so it isn't the abundance of the salt water out there that determines how many of us can thrive. It's the scarcity of the other substances that you need in order to make use of that salt water. So that's Liebig's law, and that's part of the process that we're going to have to reckon with. At this point, I'd like to bring in a concept that another sociologist came up with who probably wouldn't have thought in ecological terms at all. C. Wright Mills of Columbia University, kind of a maverick, gave a nice sociological definition of fate. Fate is what happens when innumerable people make innumerable small decisions about other matters that have a collective cumulative effect that nobody intended. Okay, that's what's happened when we overpopulated the world. Nobody intended to overpopulate the world. Nobody intended to pollute the oceans. Nobody intended to start the greenhouse effect. But each of us who decided to have one more child than we might have had, and each of us who decided to buy a bigger car, each of us who decided to heat our home rather than shivering in the winter, each of us even who bought a toothbrush and began practicing personal hygiene to live more than 70 or more than 80 or whatever. That's all of those decisions, which were perfectly natural, respectable, honorable human decisions, have brought us to the impasse that we're in now. And it truly is an impasse. And the point is, we've got to recognize that it is an impasse rather than continuing to have this hope of going on. We're not going to prolong life by building bigger and better toothbrushes. We're going to have to change our ways. I think a lot of the harm we're doing is inadvertent, of course. But just by living, especially living a modern lifestyle, we have a tremendous impact on the ecosystems upon which we are utterly dependent. And as that impact accumulates, the dependence on those ecosystems is going to begin to turn against us in a way that more and more will make life unhappy. I think that there could be a kind of cathartic effect that way, that it'll save us from having unnecessary guilt feelings. And those unnecessary guilt feelings, if we do have them, could prompt us to behave in ways that are not only self-destructive, but also vicious toward others. So to realize that there have been many species who have fouled their own nest, so to speak, that it's a natural process, should spare us those guilt feelings, and that would be helpful. In World War II, you remember, there was a lot of literature that came out. Psychologists were working on this a lot, trying to explain the Nazis in terms of guilt feelings that caused them to become vicious and so on. And misplaced aggression was the phrase that came up, where you have reason for being aggressive in your behavior, but you direct it toward somebody who isn't really to blame for your frustrations. The idea that frustration naturally, automatically produces aggressive behavior seemed to apply in World War II. And it could apply again. I don't know that there's going to be a World War III, but there's going to be ongoing conflicts because of the frustrations that people feel. And the more we can learn that those frustrations have an ecological basis and that they're neither unique to our particular group or even to our species, the more we can avoid that aggressive response to the frustrations. But you can say that as the ecological problems become more abundant and more intense, there's likely to be more violence between human beings. Think about those people that were in the dome in New Orleans after Katrina. They were experiencing an ecological problem in the sense that it was a lot of people crowded together with no access to their customary resources, and there began to be social problems within that bunch of people, within that area. They were too crowded. They couldn't sleep in their normal ways. They didn't have potable water. They didn't have access to food and so on. Those were ecological problems brought on by the impact of this hurricane, but they expressed themselves in the frictions that developed very quickly among these people in there. And so we ought to learn from that kind of an episode that ecological problems can spawn social problems and can even become social problems. Well, as I suggested somewhere in the book, and probably several places, if we don't understand what's really happening, we'll probably react in ways that make it worse. And I think we're clearly doing that now with the participation in resource wars. That's making life worse. A lot of people have died who didn't need to die. The next generation is going to have fewer resources than they would have had if we'd simply gone on overusing the resources, if we didn't have to use some of them to blast the other people's resources. The next generation could be better off than it is going to be. Someday I've got to try to find an inventory of how much petroleum has been used by the military establishments of the various countries and compare that to how what our daily rate of use is for peaceful purposes. And I haven't done that yet, but I'm sure it would be a figure that would be rather disturbing. We're going to have more resource wars, for one thing, because business as usual means we want to live the modern lifestyle with high energy activities. And it just so happens that the resources that we need to live that lifestyle are not evenly distributed over the face of the earth. So some of the people who want to live that way have to extract resources from territory that's occupied by other people, which means you have resource wars. And we're having one right now. We don't like to call it that. We don't like to pretend that what we're doing is bringing democracy to the Middle East. But we're also ravenous for the oil that can be got from the Middle East. So that'll be one of the things that happens. We won't, from a few years hence on down to the, as far as to the end of the future as you can see, we simply won't have enough of the fuels that we have become accustomed to using in the quantities that we have become accustomed to using. We're going to have to start being more efficient. And some of the efficiencies will be painful. Some of the efficiencies will be a very desirable sort of thing. Since the time of the Industrial Revolution, from the time that James Watt perfected the Newcomen engine and we began using steam power so that we were using the energy stored in what we erroneously defined as fossil fuels. It'd be better if we hadn't defined them as fuels in the first place. But we did. It was plausible. We dug up this stuff called coal and it would burn, and so you could heat your hovel with it. And you could also put it under a boiler and make power to do manufacturing and to pump the water out of the mines and to provide for transportation. And then subsequently we found a preferable kind of fossil fuel, petroleum, which has the advantage of being liquid, so it's much easier to manipulate. And then even later, natural gas, which has some advantages but also some disadvantages. We define those as fuels simply because they are combustible, and when you burn them, they release energy, and you can do all kinds of fantastic things with energy.
Why is that a misnomer?
Well, what are we doing now that we're concerned about global warming? Now that we realize that all the extra carbon dioxide that we've been putting into the atmosphere, and certain other gases too, have this greenhouse effect. We're trapping more of the heat that we get from the sun rather than re-radiating it and maintaining a constant global temperature. Now that we're concerned about global warming, one of the solutions that some imaginative people are suggesting is, oh, well, let's do sequestration of this carbon. Instead of putting it into the atmosphere where it has this greenhouse effect, let's pump it into the ground and bury it. That's where it was in the first place. If we had recognized that the Carboniferous era of this planet, way back when, was doing that for us, capturing the abundant carbon that had been part of the atmosphere in photosynthesis, vegetation that then got buried. Some of it didn't just decay and dissipate that carbon again, but got buried, and then through long process of geological pressure and so on, got converted into these fossil fuels. If we hadn't defined them as fuels, but had defined them as sequestered carbon that was happily sequestered so that animal life could have this breathable air, and that when humans came along, we could breathe it too, we'd be better off. There'd be fewer of us, and we wouldn't have all this marvelous apparatus that we have now, but at least we'd have nice, clean air to breathe.
Yeah.
And wouldn't be quite so worried about our future. we are more and more learning how to use direct solar power, but be a long way yet before we could have it replace all of the other energy sources that we use. Agriculture, of course, is using contemporary sunlight. And if I burn wood in the fireplace there, I'm burning contemporary or recent solar energy. Right. Whereas if I burn oil in the furnace, I'm burning ancient solar energy.
Right.
And so this matter of world trade, you're trying to import things from elsewhere. But in the industrial age, with our prodigal dependence upon fossil fuels, we are all committed to importing massively from elsewhere. That is, we're importing from long ago, the energy that came to this planet hundreds of thousands of years ago, millions of years ago, was converted through photosynthesis into organic matter, which was buried, some of it, and compressed and transformed by geological processes into the fossil fuels.
Right.
Those processes were sequestering all that carbon for us.
Yeah.
We made the mistake of defining it as a fuel.
Yeah.
Dig it up and burn it and ruin the atmosphere again. We're bound to damage ourselves eventually. And part of the message in my book, Overshoot, was that eventually is not way off in the future. We've already experienced some eventualities.
Yeah.
And we're experiencing more and more the what we used to think was far off in the future happening already.
What are you seeing close at hand that are the effects of that?
Well, as I say, we're about to pass over the peak of oil production. And I hope that as we do, and as the shortage begins to be more and more inescapable and makes itself felt initially just by the rising price, but more and more by simply unavailability, I hope that we'll begin to outgrow the use of the word production to refer to oil production. It should be oil extraction. For all of the fossil fuels and for all of the mineral resources, we shouldn't be talking about the rate at which we produce them. We should be talking about the rate at which we extract them. And if we had had that vocabulary in place long ago, we might be in less dire straits now. The use of the non-renewable resources has made possible the overuse of even the renewable resources, where we use them at rates in excess of their natural rate of renewal. We're doing that to the ocean. The fisheries are diminishing now. There are many, many formerly commercial fish species that are much less available than they used to be. As the topsoil diminishes, the productivity of the land will diminish. In many places, for example, in the Palouse country right now, much of the fertility of the soil is based upon artificial fertilizers that are added to the soil. The fertilizers themselves are based upon what we call the fossil fuels. Natural gas from Alaska is sometimes used in the manufacture of the anhydrous ammonia that is the principal fertilizer for the wheat country there. And so as we deplete these resources that we've been using to replenish the soil that we are depleting, then our opportunity for that replenishment will diminish. And sooner or later, the productivity of those farms will become noticeably diminished, which means there will be more hunger and more people miserable, still insisting that humans are independent of the ecosystem and not quite understanding why they suffer. That brings, of course, the concept of food chain into our discussion here, that while it is possible, as we know from successful vegetarians, to get by on a meatless diet entirely, if you have the balanced kinds of vegetable products that you put together in your diet, it doesn't happen easily. And by and large, it helps if you can have some animal products as part of your diet. We simply have become that kind of a species through the course of evolution. I used to say to my classes when I was teaching in New Zealand that it was about 10 times as hard to produce a diet fit for a Kiwi. The New Zealanders are called Kiwis, just like we're called Yanks. than for the world at large. Because as you go up the food chain, as you go up the food pyramid here, each level upward, you have a loss of roughly 9 out of 10 calories. So that to produce a diet with high in animal content would be about 10 times as hard as to produce a diet with no animal content. It is possible, but it's not likely to happen for most people. Right. And so we will have increasing malnutrition in the future, especially if we continue increasing our numbers. If we already have a third of us undernourished globally, if we insist on increasing our numbers further, we're going to have more than a third of us malnourished.
Right.
Even if we don't increase, we're probably someday going to have more than a third of us malnourished because of what we're doing to the habitat. Because we live in a society that believes in growth and believes that perpetual growth is not only possible but desirable, and then we find ourselves confronted with resource shortages, resources that used to be abundant and that we used to think the whole purpose in life was to use more lavishly, there's a cognitive dissonance between the beliefs that we absorbed in that period of exuberant growth and the situation that we're now in as we move further and further into a post-exuberant era. What are we going to do about that cognitive dissonance? Well, we look around to see if we can find more facts that will support clinging to the old beliefs. We'd rather do that than change our beliefs by coming into congruence with the new situation. Right. And to some extent, we've been able to do that for a while, but you can't do it forever. A growth economy will outgrow its resource base, and then it's in trouble. And we are doing that. And yet it's heresy today to say, let's stop growing, or even to suggest that we will eventually have to stop growing. That's virtually heresy, because we do live in with a growthist mentality. I think that the time is rapidly coming upon us when who's heretical and who's orthodox is going to reverse itself. Mm-hmm. But it'll be a painful reversal. It's ironic, of course, that we think that somehow at the societal level, growth is always and everywhere a good thing, when at the individual organism level, we know that growth has to come to a stop. I mean, you become fully grown, and if you keep on growing, you're in trouble. I remember once at a conference on population, a medical doctor was deploring the fact that some of the environmentalists would compare population growth to the growth of a cancer. He thought that was awful. Why would you equate human beings with cancer cells? And it occurred to me also when he was saying that there was all this space and so on, if you take all the people in the world and you put them in close proximity as they would be in a movie theater or something like that, then you'd still have all that space out there that would be empty. And I didn't think fast enough. But middle of that night, I thought of what my proper rejoinder to him should have been. I don't want any of my family going to you for your medical services, because you would argue that if my body is riddled with some kind of infectious agent, it doesn't matter, because all of that infectious agent, if you encapsulated it into a little cyst, would be leave the rest of the body all free and so on. That isn't the way it works. A very minute amount of an infection agent, in terms of the physical mass of it, can wreak havoc with an organism. So a minute amount of biomass in the form of human beings, minute in comparison to the size of the planet, can wreak havoc and is wreaking havoc with much of the planet. Classical economics, as I see it at least, doesn't seem to pay any attention to the actual physical world. It talks entirely in terms of markets and the exchange of goods and services and money and labor and so on. And in effect, it assumes that the physical material that all of this is going to manipulate will always be there, and the different kinds of physical material will always be available in whatever quantities the market calls for. And so the favorite response by the typical economist to any concern about a shortage of this or that or the other thing is, well, the shortage will make the price go up, and as the price goes up, there will be more incentive to go and find more. And so whenever they even say it quite in those terms, as the price of gasoline rises, there will be more incentive to build refineries, and there will be more incentive to drill in various places. They act as if incentive is the only issue, rather than the actual physical availability of the resource that you're going to try to go and find. And I think that what we have become, in a way, in the modern industrial era, is another hunting and gathering society. We think of hunter-gatherers as primitive people, when they just relied upon the largesse of nature. Well, we've become, in a massive, colossal way, hunters and gatherers. We hunt for all of these non-renewable resources, and then what we call production, which should be called extraction, is a gathering process. We bring it to where we can use it, and we use it up, and we go and hunt for more, and without regard to how fast nature produces these things, produces in the real sense of the word, produce. I suppose the most general, deeply ingrained assumption we have to overcome is that the progress that we've experienced in the past was all unadulterated progress, and that we can extrapolate it indefinitely into the future. It wasn't always progress. We were making some regressive changes too in the past, but the mere fact that we have been able several times to increase the proportion of the life support that the planet provides to be used by humans rather than others, we've been able to do that several times, doesn't mean we can always do it in the future, particularly by the means that we've been most recently trying to do it, by relying on phantom carrying capacity instead of real carrying capacity. There are many times in which people just don't want to be told that such and such a place is off limits to them. There was a place, the little village in Michigan where my uncle grew up, who went on to become a Civil War historian. He wrote about the last standing virgin tree in that town, and how the lumbermen came in and they just couldn't stand the sight of it, and they had to cut it down. And after they cut it down, the log lay there for a long time without anybody hauling it off and making any use of it. And the stump became a place where his little sister, my aunt, would play with her dolls and so on. And I think that's the attitude that the oil industry has now about we need to drill more and more places. But drilling more and more places merely postpones to a modest extent the day of reckoning. It doesn't get us out of trouble. We have had that idea ever since we started this industrialization process, that we were getting more and more control of everything around us. But it's not that new an idea. I mean, you go back to the book of Genesis in the Bible, the idea that man was meant to be in control. Supposedly, we were given divine dominion over all the other creatures. And I guess for a while it didn't do any harm. We were, in a sense, in some control, and we were capable, because of what we got up here, to continue expanding that control. But I think we've clearly overdone it now, and we need to recognize that we can't control everything, and that we can't make the planet non-finite. There are certain principles of physics and chemistry that we can't violate. When you burn something, you can't unburn it again easily. The only way you can unburn it is to put the energy back into it that you got out of it by burning it. And even then, that'll be imperfect. You'll still lose something in the process. The idea that we're going to solve our problems by using hydrogen as our principal fuel is silly, because it takes as much energy to extract the hydrogen from the water, which would be its principal source, as you'd get from burning the hydrogen. And there may be some other shortcuts that can be taken that'll make it useful as a a repository of energy, but not as a source of energy. So we've got to learn some modesty that we haven't had in recent generations.
Yeah.
There's been good reasons that we weren't modest, but we've got to realize that those reasons are obsolete and that we need to be modest. We're experiencing in many ways some serious cultural lags where norms that made sense in an earlier era when we had room to grow and when there was an abundance of even the non-renewable resources and so on and so on, those norms that made sense under those conditions persist even though they don't make so much sense in the world that we have today. I suspect that many people use a form of denial that wouldn't quite be called denial. It's shrugging it off, that what can I do about it? I can't do anything about it, so why think about it? I would guess that that's probably the majority reaction among people who do sense that it's coming apart, that the world is never going to be what we grew up thinking of it as being, and so on. A small fraction of the population knows how bad things are, mainly ecologists. More people sense how bad things are without knowing. I mean, there's this feeling of unease that somehow it's going to fall apart. I might lose my job tomorrow. I might, we could have a number 9 earthquake here. Suddenly this could all tumble down around me. Or if you lived in Louisiana, there might be another big hurricane like that. And so you've got a couple of million people that really did feel that everything fell apart for a while. They're still clinging to the notion that we can put it back together again. And collectively, they're recognizing that they need a lot of help from the federal government. And the federal government is talking as if somehow we're going to spend $200 billion on rebuilding the Gulf Coast, but there must be an awful lot of people there who realize that it's never going to be what it was. No matter how many hundreds of billions of dollars are spent on it, it won't be the same. Mm-hmm. And people like that, I think, are people in that situation. I shouldn't say people like that. They're just like you and me. There are other people. But people in that kind of situation may be receptive to the blandishments of leaders who will say, oh, yes, we can put it back together. It'll just take a while. Meanwhile, you can live in a trailer, and so on. If you remember the movie version of Jules Verne's Round the World in 80 Days, mm-hmm. Remember he's trying to get back across the Atlantic after having gone all the way around and get back to the club in England where he's going to win the bet. And the steamer that he's on is running out of fuel. And he's rich enough so that he buys the steamer and he tells them to start tearing down the superstructure, and they're putting it into the furnace, and they manage by tearing down the whole superstructure, so all they've got is the hull and the people standing on it, and finally limps into port, and he gets to the club a day later than he thought he was going to, and then he suddenly remembers we've gone around so that by crossing the date line it isn't a day later. He calmly walks in and he wins his bet. Well, that image of tearing down the superstructure to maintain the headway is, I think, a way of thinking about the future of Homo Colossus in industrial societies. I think I alluded to the alcoholic as a possible example of that. Suppose that you have a person who was a good provider for his family, had a good job, earned a good income, and something goes wrong and he turns to the bottle. And he becomes less of a good provider. Okay, realizing that he's less of a good provider, that's a thought he can't abide. So he turns to the bottle some more and more, and he becomes less and less a good provider. It becomes one of those circular reactions where positive feedback is the cybernetic term for it, where his way of coping with the problem, his problem of identity strain, coping with that problem makes that problem worse, as well as making the problem that caused the identity strain worse, too. And I think there's a lot of that happening now. What do we want to do about living in a world where we're overusing the resources? get more and more ways of getting more and more of those resources. In other words, overuse them. And particularly if we have to fight over the access to them, that overuses them in a truly insufferable way. Well, I think we have to begin by simply acknowledging that humans are part of an ecosystem, that we need to see human society not as something that's totally autonomous and thus independent of the lower sciences, so to speak, but that we are part of an ecosystem. We dominate the ecosystems that we are part of nowadays, and the dominance has really gotten out of hand with our modern technology and so on. There were ancient examples, though, of people in the early years of irrigation farming, almost 10,000 years ago. They could, over time, ruin the soil that had been so fertile because it would become salinated. And there were many instances in which people used an environment in such a way that they changed it in a way that seemed to be beneficial to them initially, but that eventually brought about enough different circumstances than it had when they moved in there that it no longer would serve the uses that it had before. Today, of course, one of the ways in which we are having an impact upon a global environment that is adverse to the human future is all of the stuff we're putting into the atmosphere and all of the pollution that we put into the streams. It used to be that you could dispose of sewage by just dumping it in the river, but then there's a downstream community that is trying to draw water from that river. And so what we need to do is all imagine that we live downstream rather than assuming that we live upstream. The word that comes to mind is not from the ecological literature per se, but from modern advertising. Downsizing is what we've got to do. We've got to take this Homo colossus that we have become, like that 41-ton dinosaur, each of us, and shrink ourselves down by using less apparatus, or at least using much more efficient apparatus to carry on a way of life that is more modest and more frugal. We have been, again, to use a biblical term, we have been prodigal. That's the essence of modern American life and the essence of the life of the other modern industrial nations, that we are prodigal. We're using resources that are not replaceable, and we're using even the renewable resources faster than their rates of renewal. Either there have to be fewer of us doing it, or each of us has to do less of it. We have to use less water per capita. We have to, I was going to say, breathe less air per capita by means of those synthetic nostrils that the exhaust pipe on the truck represent. Right. We've simply got to be less colossal than we have grown accustomed to being. Living with a minimal footprint on the land is the idea that just as we've gradually learning to define carrying capacity, we need also to define what our footprint is, that each of us in using resources and having an impact is a larger creature than we have heretofore recognized. Can we live more lightly on the land? We've built our cities such that people commute several miles to buy groceries. For the most part, we don't buy from a little neighborhood store. We buy from a supermarket, which may be several miles from where we live, as well as commuting even more miles to where we work. And having built the cities that way, where we're utterly dependent on the automobile, where there's precious little adequate public transportation in cities, it's going to take a long time to rebuild them so that we can live more locally, which we'll have to do when we don't have the fuel or can't afford the fuel for those long commutes. It may be that there will be some automatic response in that direction, ironically, by the fact that we will be less mobile in the future as the fuel becomes scarce. I was going to say that to do that, we need barriers between these separate little communities. But you don't want to erect a barrier that says, hey, you keep out, I don't like you. But insofar as there are natural barriers, it has that effect. The natural barriers will emerge when we become less mobile. There are some problems, of course, that are obviously attributable to the misbehavior of other people. And we get in the habit of thinking that way, and so problems that arise not from recognized misbehavior, but from the cumulative effects of what we take as normal behavior, it's much more comfortable for us to try to look for a culprit that we can blame for that behavior than to say, oh, well, gee, we've all been living in such a way that we undermined our very existence. When we feel overwhelmed, we are receptive to leaders who will oversimplify. If they will tell us that it isn't really as overwhelming as it seems, because look, here's the magic answer to it. Drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will solve our problem of an oil shortage. For how long? Not very, but if they can come up with some kind of single answer that we can focus our attention on, or if they can come up with some activity that distracts us from that which was overwhelming us, with all these little symbols on the cars, support our troops and so on, a distraction will do. Politicians always, when they talk about these problems confronting us, think they have to end by saying, tomorrow will be a better day, we'll make it a better day by solving these problems and so on. And I really do think that that has become more and more misleading. Even Jimmy Carter, when he was wearing the sweater in front of the fireplace and so on and talking about the energy crisis of that time, when was that, early 1970s, thought he had to say positive things like that at the end. There I am using the word positive with a favorable connotation again. I think that's misleading in the sense that it tells us that we don't need to start doing any real downsizing. And I think that's a serious mistake. We really do need to under-reproduce for a while. We need to have our machines under-reproduce for a while, too, so that we don't become more and more colossal. We become less and less Homo colossus and go back more and more toward being mere Homo sapiens. We need to stop assuming that there's a gas station just ahead. And if we're starting to run out of fuel, we need to recognize that that means we're going to have to get out and walk. That's a figure of speech, of course, for saying we need to do more with what we are rather than with what we have. We need to recognize and reconcile ourselves to the fact that we are going to have less in the future. It's not all bad. There's going to be some positive effects of it, but we will make them more positive if we recognize that they're inevitable than if we think we can fight that and continue to cling to the onward and upward attitude that we've had for the last century or so. I would advocate trying to be as realistic as possible about the odds against a positive, a favorable future. We need to overcome the notion that humans are, we need to understand better the uniqueness of humans. Humans are, by being a language-using animal, capable of social differentiation, rather than having to wait for the slower process of speciation that has produced all this variety of life forms out around us. And we've got to recognize that there are limits even to that, the extent to which we can be socially differentiated and the smoothness with, or the harmony with which the socially differentiated people will interact with each other is limited. So we've got to understand the nature of human uniqueness better than we have in the past, and we've got to stop thinking that because we are human and therefore unique, unlike in some respect all other creatures, we are exempt from the processes that can be observed happening among other creatures. And there are so many instances of other species over-proliferating and destroying the life support system upon which they depended, we've got to learn from those examples. And we won't learn from them as long as we continue to cling to this human uniqueness notion and fail to understand the real nature of our uniqueness. I think this partly arises from the fact that this country had the good fortune to get through two world wars on other people's soil. And we sort of assumed that because we had the Atlantic Ocean on one side and the Pacific Ocean on the other side protecting us, that that meant wars were always something you fought elsewhere. And sure, we had the loss of our own troops over there and all that, but we didn't have to think of war in the same way that those poor benighted peoples in the areas where the wars happened thought of them. And it was assumed that we could go on winning wars forever. So that's a kind of an expression of our sense of dominance.
Yeah.
Then, of course, when we had possession uniquely of nuclear weapons, aha, now the world will see that we are superior and we'll have a Pax Americana and so on. And it didn't work out that way. We had a Cold War instead. There are two ways in which we can diminish the load. One is to diminish the per capita use of resources. The other is to diminish the capitas, reduce population, which means under-reproducing for a while. Or it means slaughtering each other, which we sometimes do. And I would prefer that we not do that. I would prefer that we have voluntary under-reproduction, which I think we may have to some extent as people understand the situation better, as to some extent the Chinese did succeed in getting the one-child family. They didn't perfectly, but they sure did cut down their rate of growth somewhat.
Yeah.
And we need to do that, but we also need to do the downsizing from Homo colossus to Homo sapiens, as well as reducing the number of us at the Homo sapiens level. I don't think we can reduce our population from 6 billion to 1 billion within one human lifetime. Certainly we can't do it comfortably within one human lifetime. We might do it within one human lifetime catastrophically. But the more rapidly we do it, the better the world that our descendants will inherit will be. The more rapidly we do it, the more the people undergoing that reduction will suffer. I'm not advocating anything like the Nazis' final solution. I don't mean that we ought to instigate a big Holocaust. I don't mean anything like that. But we're experiencing a drastic cultural lag in our lives right now. Cultural lag, William F. Ogburn at the University of Chicago in 1922 defined as when one part of a culture that was in adjustment with another part of the culture changes more than the other part does, so that they get out of adjustment. The demographic transition, as it's sometimes called, where we reduce the reduce the death rate, but kept the birth rate high, or the birth rate got reduced only subsequent to the reduction of the death rate. That produced the population explosion, as we've called it. Now, we've seen that it's not as explosive as Malthus would have suggested it could have been, but it's explosive enough. We needed to do more in the way of reducing the birth rate sooner. And now we need to have a period in which the birth rate is actually below the death rate, preferably achieved by reducing birth rates further rather than by increasing death rates. Our global population is going to be reduced. Now, whether we reduce it voluntarily or whether it is reduced by forces over which we don't have as much control as we imagine we have, or some mixture of the two, that remains to be seen. If we decide we want to reduce it, we can see to it that the reduction occurs in a more humane way than it will occur if we just try to keep on business as usual. Think of one of the concerns that already is beginning to stir people up in Washington, D.C. now, the possibility that bird flu will mutate in such a way that it would be transmissible not just from fowl to human, but from human to human, so that we might have a global pandemic of a serious variety of flu. That would be part of what could do it. Nuclear war could be part of what could reduce population. Those are what Malthus referred to as positive checks. It would be better if we could do more with preventive checks, but the preventive checks are not cost-free. If we reduce the birth rate drastically, then we do change the age structure of the population in such a way that's going to produce some economic hardships. Well, I think we are on the almost on the brink, at least, if not on the brink of a crash. I've tried to suggest that there's more than one way of crashing. Part of the crash could be downsizing Homo colossus to get back to being more like just plain Homo sapiens, by being less ravenous of resources and so on. To use the space age terminology, what we're trying to do is to have a soft landing instead of a hard landing. So maybe we need to get out from under the word crash as such. The ecological meaning of crash means, of course, the collapse of a population, the collapse of a community, the collapse of an ecosystem. And human societies have collapsed in the past. There have been a number of good examples. This book by Jared Diamond is, everybody should read that. And then they should read this little thing, or in the other order maybe, The Collapsing Bubble by Lindsey Grant. Because they tell how collapses have happened in the past, and we can learn from studying that past history. I would hate to have us behave as the Nazis behaved. Thinking that they could solve their problems by slaughtering another whole population. And yet, the Nazis were not unique in that respect. There have been other instances of genocide. And I think you can show that some of those other instances of genocide, at least, have arisen from the kinds of pressures that are getting beyond carrying capacity are now producing for us. So we could follow in the footsteps of the Nazis, even those of us who thought we had ended that kind of a threat by defeating the Nazis. I hope we won't do it that way. And the preservation of human dignity might depend on our discovering instances of dignity even amongst our enemies, even amongst the people we do define as our adversaries.